Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How robust is the institution of the jury trial in the United States? And what would we sacrifice if it were to all but disappear from the legal system? While TV characters seem to spend a lot of time in court, the number of real-life trials has shrunk dramatically in recent years, leaving power that used to belong to peer-populated juries largely in the hands of judges, and vastly reducing the opportunities for public airing of the facts of many cases. My guest today worries it is a dangerous and disturbing development, and he's here now to talk about why. Robert P. Burns is professor at Northwestern University's School of Law. His new book is called The Death of the American Trial. Bob, welcome to Think.
Thank you very kindly. Happy to be here.
You write that the word death here is not hyperbole. What tells you that the trial is facing its demise?
Well, there's a blizzard of statistics that say that. In 2002, the last year that we have really good numbers, less than 2% of federal civil cases ended at trial, down from about 12% 40 years earlier and 25% in the 30s. So there's a dramatic decrease. The percentage of criminal cases going to trial in the federal courts has declined about 70% during the quarter century from 76 through 2002. There's been a real change in the percentage of cases that are resolved by judges on paper before getting to trial. In one district where it was studied carefully, in 1975, twice as many cases were resolved by jury trial or by trial as by summary disposition, which is an on-the-paper kind of proceeding where a judge just rules by himself, so twice as many by trial as by summary judgment. And by 2000, three times as many cases were being resolved on summary judgment, behind closed doors, on the papers, without any kind of presentation of witnesses, and certainly no jury, as by trial. So there's been a complete turnaround in those numbers. And it's true in the state systems as well. From 1992 to 2001, the percentage of trials in the 75 most populous counties around the country declined by about 50%. If you do it by populous states, in between 76 and 2002, the number of jury trials is down by about 70%. So there's an enormous implosion is the term that the social scientists use. That has occurred, and it seems to be accelerating in the last years. That percentage, that decline, that fall is even steeper than it had been in the years before. So, I think it's really a destruction of an important part of our institutional infrastructure. It's easy to see when a bridge collapses or a city is flooded, but it's harder to see when an important institution starts to disappear or corrode. And I think that's what's happened in the jury trial and in the trial even in front of a judge over the last 25 years, accelerating in the recent past.
I realize that you did not write this book specifically as a study of why the number of trials is falling off, but we can hardly discuss the impact of the reality until we address that. Can you offer some basic insight into why there are so many fewer trials today than there were a few decades ago?
Yeah, we're just guessing on that. We like to call them explanations, but they're really guesses at this point. And you can look at that, I think, through a microscope or through a telescope. If you look at it closely, you can see sort of this taking the small picture through a sort of microscope. So the trial skills that allow lawyers to try cases has atrophied, and there's a kind of, you can see it's a kind of vicious circle. As fewer lawyers are able to try cases well, they become more afraid to try cases. They get less experience in trying cases, and then they become more afraid to try cases. So that's the small picture that explains why that's taking place. It's also a change in the culture of judging. Judges have become more often what are called managerial judges who think they're problem solvers and they're trying to solve specific problems. And their main task is not to preside over public trials and public jury trials. So the attitude that As one judge put it, the best settlement is the worst settlement is better than the best trial has affected the judiciary. Costs have risen. Doctrine that allows cases to be thrown out on motions to dismiss right up at the front part of the case, or on summary judgment after parties basically present written argument. The doctrines that have made that easier have become stronger. So that's another reason, sort of through the microscope, that that the number of jury trials and trials in general have taken place. So that's the sort of micro explanation. And then there are some guesses, more broad gauged kind of guesses, broad brush guesses. People talk about a drift towards a more bureaucratic, sometimes even imperial bureaucratic set of institutions, where things get decided by experts and elites behind closed doors. And there's a broad drift towards that in our society as a whole, looking at this development from a broad brush point of view. And of course, these are all guesses. This development has picked up so quickly in the recent past that the best social scientists are just trying to just begin to try to understand what's going on. But I think it's really important to focus on this development because of what's at stake and what we can lose if this development continues.
Well, what is the essential goal of a trial, and does it differ fundamentally from the goal of an adjudication that takes place outside of a trial court?
Yeah, I think the trial basically allows for a determination to be made, a judgment about that is factually accurate, and this is a great advantage that a trial has over the other sort of public forums we have. You can think of congressional hearings, or you can think of press conferences. What trials have are a panoply of procedures: opening statement, presentation of direct examination under the rule of evidence, cross examination, the ability to present contrary evidence that really get to the heart of a factual matter. So, what a trial can do that these other forums can't do, including summary dispositions. In the judges' chambers on paper, and certainly that we don't get in congressional hearings, and certainly we don't get in press conferences where the person being examined can just go on to the next person if he doesn't like the question, doesn't want to answer the question anymore. What we get is a much more precise attention to simple questions of fact, and that's a big thing. It's easy to miss what that means. So one philosopher put it, falsehood is the handmaiden of injustice. And what the trial does is try to reduce that falsehood down to a point much lower than you're going to get through most of those other institutions. So you have that importance of factual accuracy, which the devices of the trial provide. And you also have the kind of multiplicity of perspectives that you get both from the judge and the jury. You get the sense of ordinary morality and common sense on questions of fact and questions of law that you get from a jury that you can't get through the professionals. G.K. Chesterton, a great English essayist, wrote a wonderful little essay called The Twelve in the early part of the last century, and after serving on an English jury. And he wrote this essay, and his basic argument was that the reason why the jury is essential is that rule by expert is experts, and rule by professionals like judges have their limitations. And at a certain point, the more times you see something, you don't see more of it, you see less and less and less of it. And what the jury does is bring fresh eyes and fresh sensibilities into a place where the judge is always tempted to say, well, I've seen it before, I know what this is about, I don't need to look so hard. So that's an important thing that the trial contributes that isn't available if judgments are made on paper records. So you have two things. You have factual accuracy, and then you have a broader range of perspectives that come from the citizenry disciplined by procedure, and that's what the trial really contributes. One author talks about the discipline of the evidence, the way in which the jury's common sense and judgment is elevated by the varied devices of the trial themselves to really make for good judgment. And jurors often come away from the experience of trying cases sort of amazed at saying, in a sense, geez, I didn't know we could do this. I didn't know we could reach such a refined judgment together that I actually saw that we did. So all those things, I think, a trial provides that can't be provided through our other institutions or other devices.
Let's talk more about the jury, because critics of the American trial have argued many times that a jury of one's peers is at best difficult to seat and at worst likely to be made up of people without the skills to make well-reasoned decisions. Can you talk a little bit more about why you so passionately disagree?
Yeah, Mark Twain talked about 12 people of average ignorance. There's a panoply of studies that basically show that juries do really well, and that social scientists and jurors and judges who spend a lot of time with jury trials come away with a respect for the institution. And it isn't a plebiscite. I mean, you're just not asking people what their first impression of a case is. What I want to emphasize is the way in which the trial itself, the discipline of the trial itself, makes for better decision making, and I think people who have studied that carefully have come away with that conclusion. The great old study of the American jury was by Calvin and Zeisel called The American Jury, and the conclusion they reached there was that the judge and the jury basically agreed 80% of the time. And where they disagreed, it was because the perspectives they brought to bear on the case, largely factual perspectives, were different. It wasn't that they were the jury was ignoring what the judge told them or anything like that. It's just they saw the case differently, and better, frankly, in my view, by virtue of there being more than one person. You know, recent popular book called The Wisdom of Crowds that more eyes are better than one, and deliberation is important, and multiple perspectives is important, and not just the old Chesterton argument, not just seeing it as just another one of those cases that I've seen over and over again. All of those things are important. And the judge and the jury is not just subject to the discipline of the evidence, direct examination, cross-examination, the obsessive concern about the facts of the individual case that you see nowhere else, not to be offensive, but certainly not in in most journalism and most mass circulation material. You see a level of concern about factual accuracy and really understanding the meaning of an individual set of human actions that exists nowhere else. And it's that encounter of multiple perspectives with the discipline of the trial that I think elevates jury decision-making and makes it a great institution, one of our great cultural achievements.
Robert P. Burns is a professor at Northwestern University School of Law. We're talking about his new book, The Death of the American Trial. You're welcome to join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can join us via email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Robert P. Burns. He's professor of law at Northwestern University. His new book is called The Death of the American Trial. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Bob, we in Texas, and particularly in Dallas County, have had a lot of occasions recently to ponder the frequency with which juries might reach the wrong verdict as DNA evidence exonerates people who were convicted of capital crimes.
Yeah.
Can you offer some perspective on that?
Well, there have been false convictions. There's little doubt about that. At my law school, we have a division of our clinical program that is designed to re-examine those kinds of false convictions, and they've done a great job at that. It seems that most, and this is a proposition that goes beyond false confessions, I think that most of the failures of our trial system, whether a jury trial or bench trial system, the result of not of any sort of essential defect in the way cases are tried within the courtroom, but of the bureaucratic and mainly bureaucratic, sometimes market systems within which this trial process is embedded. Most of the false convictions are the result of false eyewitness identification, and there's a lot of suspicion that much of that false eyewitness identification, the result of faulty show-ups or faulty lineups before trial. Some of it is, which is just the end of the refusal of trial judges to allow the defense to offer expert witness testimony about the circumstances under which eyewitness identification can go wrong. Many of the false convictions are the result of are false confessions that have been coerced by often vulnerable defendants, children or people of limited intelligence or ego strength, if you want. And those false confessions are very difficult to overcome. Juries tend to believe confessions and believe that people don't have any reason to confess falsely because they don't have a real sense of the pressure that can take place in an interrogation or an extended interrogation. And I think that raises a general issue, which is a problem about bureaucracy, the way in which our law of evidence is in many ways over-technical and excludes evidence that the jury, our mature juries, are juries who are much more well-educated and who take their tasks very seriously than was the case in the older English juries that the aristocratic judges thought they had to control through the law of evidence. Our law of evidence is hyper-technical in some ways and keeps out important information away from the jury. Then, unfortunately, I don't know about the Dallas situation, but there have been circumstances in which prosecutorial misconduct or police misconduct has been part of the basis for false confessions, the withholding of relevant evidence that prosecution is obliged to turn over. That's an issue that crops up over and over again in this context. Failures in police-related labs, I know you had some problems with this in Texas. Poor procedures, sloppy procedures, procedures that are too partisan for an institution that is supposed to care about factual accuracy, not just getting convictions. So I think the studies tend to show that those are the basis for most of the false convictions that take place. Now, it's a human institution. Any human institution is going to go off the track sometimes. But I think it's the bureaucratic shell and sometimes the market shell, inadequate resources going to the defense in some circumstances, that have resulted in most of the false convictions. So I don't take that as evidence of a fundamental flaw in the institution of the trial or the jury trial itself.
Is there empirical evidence that the move to resolve more criminal cases by plea bargaining also encourages false confessions?
It's almost impossible to study that.
Yeah.
because you never get back beyond, or you rarely will get back beyond a plea bargain that has taken place, because both parties walk away from that situation, and there's not likely to be DNA or anything else that would show that to be false. But if you think about what plea bargaining does, it puts in the hands of the often in the hands of the prosecutor, sometimes in the hands of the judge, an enormous power to make the defense and basically an offer they can't refuse. Insofar as the prosecutor can engage in what's called charge bargaining, in other words, agree to reduce the charges down to a lower charge where the judge can impose a much lower maximum, or the prosecutor can recommend probation at the far end of the circumstance, you can create a situation where in very weak cases, in cases in which the defendant is truly not guilty, the prosecution is able to make an offer that the defense can't refuse, and that's been it's been studied. That this is a story that goes back into the 19th century. Recently, in the federal system, the sentencing guidelines imposed mandatory minimums and maximums in a way that sharpened this effect. I think you get a drift towards more plea bargain cases. Now we're below 5% of cases actually going to trial in the criminal context because of offers that the defense can't refuse. The paradigm case for me is a woman with a single mother with children who is accused of being complicit in a bank robbery because she waited outside a bank behind the wheel of a car while a man that she knows goes in and commits the robbery. And the question is, was she aware of his plan or not? She claims that she wasn't, that she was taken advantage of, she was ignorant of what she was going to do. But she has two or three children at home, and she can get probation if she agrees to plead to the offense. She faces perhaps 8 or 10 years in jail as a mandatory minimum if she's convicted. That's an offer that can't be refused, and there are many other examples of that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're talking about the new book, The Death of the American Trial, by Northwestern University Law School Professor Robert P. Burns. Let's go first to Irving and speak to Bala. Hi, Bala.
Yes, good evening. Good afternoon.
Hi.
I'm calling to ask a question.
Sure.
Yes, sir. Good afternoon. I just want to find out, if at all this trend continues, while you're having less trials, and that gives judges less experience, what kind of judges should we expect then in the future to ascend up to the Supreme Court when we talk about judicial temperament and all whatnot?
If I understand the question, I think, you know, Supreme Court judges that Judge Sotomayor is unique among the current Supreme Court on this, in that she was a trial judge for quite some number of years. Most trial judges, by the way, have enormous respect for the jury. I think when you're talking about the Supreme Court and federal appellate court justices, I think you want judges at that level who do have respect for the trial court and have respect for the jury, and would be skeptical of actions taken in the trial court that basically take cases away from the jury, that make it easier for the trial judge to direct a verdict, to grant summary judgment, or to dismiss a case without jury deliberation and without a trial. And I think that's I think appellate court judges who have no trial experience perhaps would be a little more likely to think that judges' determinations are better than jury determinations, and non-trial determinations may be superior to trial determinations. And I think she brings a perspective that will likely counter that sort of professional prejudice of appellate court judges.
You mentioned earlier, Bob, that in 80% of the cases, the jury and the judge seem to be on the same page about the verdict. Do we know anything statistically about the outcome of jury verdicts as compared with the outcomes of or trial verdicts as the outcome of cases decided outside of trial?
Yes, that's a really large question. On the first part of it, let me say, by the way, when that study showed 80% level of agreement, that probably understates it, because the method that the investigators used was to ask the trial judge, while the jury was out of the courtroom, how would you have decided the case? And what that does is it sort of lets the judge off the hook on the sort of personal responsibility for actually deciding the case, and probably tilts the judge towards saying he would have decided the case in a way that is more consistent with ordinary understandings of the way judges ought to decide, perhaps somewhat more mechanically than they actually do. So I think the level of agreement is probably higher than that. I don't think there's any hard evidence of the way the relative quality of the results of jury deliberations compared to negotiated settlements or mediated settlements or arbitrated settlements. Because it's a question of quality, it's going to be very hard to get at that kind of question. There is no doubt that. It has always been true and ought to continue to be true that most cases are resolved without trial. Most cases should be resolved by some kind of agreement of the parties. But what we're seeing here now is such an implosion of the availability of trial that you're getting a situation, and this is one problem, that getting a situation where settlements are being decided based on previous settlements. There's no sort of touchstone or standard that's set by determinations of cases on the merits. The two areas where people talk about this are in securities regulation, where so few cases, securities cases, where so few cases go to trial that the proper settlement of case number 100 is decided by the settlement of the previous 99 cases without the proper level of damages ever assessed. And the other is in child support cases, where the same thing happens. The case is never really adjudicated, and so you get this internal process of negotiation built on negotiation built on negotiation, and all out of public view. So you lose the public perspective on those kinds of important determinations, and that's what leads some of our federal judges to say things like, the trial is the canary in the mine shaft. If it goes, our people lose their inherited right to do justice. Or another federal judge saying that democracy dies behind closed doors. So you're losing a public perspective on the merits of those kinds of cases. Everything gets settled, and the problem with that is they may get settled in a way that doesn't reflect the merits, but basically the comparative power of each side. So those settlements can be muscled because of differentiated resources, for example, in civil cases.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Grand Prairie and speak with Tim. Hi, Tim.
I'm afraid
I
can't hear Tim.
We can't hear you. We definitely want to take your call. Can you?
I'm coming out of the canyon in downtown Dallas right now.
There you go. Okay, now we can hear you.
You're
driving in the right spot.
I appreciate you for patience. I just wanted to speak for a moment to what your guest had already spoken about whenever I was on, and my personal experience exactly is I was involved in the court system and the justice system in a situation where, and I find this often, where the presumed guilt was already there beforehand, and especially in the prosecution, where, I was originally charged with a felony of the level, it was a strong arm robbery. I was allowed to plead out on resisting arrest and sentenced to 14 days in jail, and was able to perform that on one day a week on the weekends a work release program. Now, if you look at the disparity between what I was charged with and what I was allowed to plead out on, it seems to me only a simple-minded person could only come to the conclusion that the prosecutor obviously didn't believe there was much guilt there. And I just don't understand, you know, I had to take that plea. I could not risk my family and my livelihood on 12 individuals being intelligent. And I'd just like to hear your guest's comments on that off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for calling. What do you think, Bob?
Well, I think overcharging is a problem. And overcharging has, you know, gives the prosecution enormous resources to do exactly what your guest described. Of course, I don't know about his individual case, but that's a problem. And continually to elevate the number of finely gradated offenses with very different punishment levels, and the drive that takes place in all state legislatures just about to show that we're tough on crime by continuing to increase the penalties that that attach to crimes makes this problem more serious. Prosecutors feel that they have too many cases to take to trial, and therefore they need to dispose of many, many cases through plea bargaining. And this helps them do that. And so they're as an institutional matter, are likely to support the legal structure that allows for overcharging. But it really can render citizens, perhaps your caller as well, cynical about the process of justice. So it's determined not based on the facts and the law presented in a court of law, but on this sort of muscled process of negotiation. And I think that's a corrupting thing. It makes people cynical about the justice system and the availability of justice.
Robert P. Burns is a professor at Northwestern School, University School of Law. We're talking about his book, The Death of the American Trial. We'll resume our conversation in a moment and welcome you to join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Robert P. Burns. He is a professor at Northwestern University School of Law who's written a new book called The Death of the American Trial. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. Bob, what did trials do for us as a society trying to understand and interpret and document our most essential legal and cultural values?
Yeah, this was important to Alexis de Tocqueville in Democracy in America. He wrote about the importance of the trial for self-government, that the civil trial and the criminal trial were both important devices of self-government. And that certainly reflects the view of the founding fathers. The Constitution almost went aground because there was not in the original Constitution a right for jury trials in civil cases. And only when the Federalist promise to put the Seventh Amendment in the Bill of Rights that guaranteed that right, were they able to get the Constitution confirmed by the what became the state legislatures. But I think the experience of self-governance in trial is an important aspect of what the trial provides. It's the notion that I mentioned before, the canary in the mineshaft, if we lose our inherited rights to do justice in court, other democratic institutions will lose breath as well. De Tocqueville talked about the spirit of magistracy, the responsibility that comes from deciding not only your own private interests, but public interests that involved other people in a responsible public way. And that experience, I think, is a very important experience. He talked about it scraping away the rust of selfishness that is the bane of all society, especially an individualist society like the United States. Those are important values in lots of for the experience of self governance. And I think as well the. The nature of the trial, its face-to-face nature, has always been understood as a counterweight to just bureaucratizing the systems of social order. When people are face-to-face, they realize in some ways, this is Thomas Green's argument in Verdict According to Conscience, that the law, even though it's bureaucratic and technical, is ultimately about justice. And the face-to-face nature of the trial enforces that conviction. The dramatic nature of the trial points out, allows people to experience, to engage with those important sort of moral as well as legal and political issues that are at stake in often just even the simplest of cases, and gives people an experience of trying to discern what is most important in individual cases. So I think from the point of view of self-governance, the experience of participation in the legal system is an important one. And I think the quality of justice is elevated because of that.
We'll return now to the phones and this time speak to Oli in Dallas. Hi, Oli.
Hi. I have a unique interest in this program because our organization investigates religious fraud. And I've been sued so many times I can't even count it. But if it wasn't for the summary judgment, these slap suits or the strategic lawsuits against public participation would clog the courts forever. And I'd just like to know your comment about that, sort of in the defense of the settlement before the summary judgment, as opposed to having all these innumerable cases go to trial.
What do you think, Bob?
Two things. Most trials are very short. Like more than 70% of trials are over in a day. So we have the vision of the O.J. Simpson case, this endless elephant of a case that never ends. But most are really can be run very efficiently and cleanly. There are some studies that show that the process of summary judgment actually sucks up more resources in terms of depositions and brief writing and argumentation and the presentation of the technical papers that support summary judgment. It sucks up more resources than a well-disciplined trial would. So it's not necessarily true that summary judgment is a more efficient, cleaner, less expensive route than going to trial. And in those situations like employment discrimination or sometimes antitrust, where an element is sort of conspiratorial intent, where the plaintiff does not have access to the state of mind of the defendant, it's very hard to survive summary judgment. And only the trial, where the jury can make or judge can make up his own mind about what the state of mind of the defendant was, gives the plaintiff a chance to establish those things. That said, I don't think every case should go to trial. I think there are frivolous cases filed, and there are some cases that are so clearly beyond the pale of that could be proven at trial, and that's clear earlier on, that they should be dismissed ahead of time. I just think that what's happened over the last 25 years or the last 10 years is an enormous tilt in the wrong direction. Too many cases are resolved without trial, and not enough cases where there really is a question of state of mind or real question of fact or a question of interpretation that really needs the trials, the richness of the trials' devices to make that determination. Too many of those cases are dismissed. And what your caller says raises a bigger question about You know, the trial itself is sometimes caricatured as a sort of populist, undisciplined populist discussion among jurors, and it's much more than that. It's much more structured. The law of rules has its place. The law of evidence excludes unreliable evidence. There are parliamentary rules that keep the trial from degenerating into a raw appeal to emotion. So the trial itself embodies those values of structure and order and discipline and legality, but does so in a way that represents that also honors other values: democratic decision making, the wisdom of crowds, the importance of moral sensibilities in resolving many cases. In a way that I think is unique. It's unique in the United States, in our institutions, and certainly unique in the world. I think we've gone much too far in the direction of trying to avoid trials at all costs.
Is it your sense that trials leave legal clients any more or less vulnerable to the shortcomings of an attorney who, for whatever reason, is either not fully competent or not fully engaged?
Yeah, I mean, that raises this question about the sort of market structure within which trials are placed. One of the disadvantages of the adversary system, as we have it in the United States and exists in England to a lesser extent, is that it is more sensitive to economic imbalances between the sides, and that may play out in differential abilities between the lawyers on either side. On the continent, the judge is a much more authoritarian system. The judge conducts the inquiry. There really aren't trials in our sense, a single event. It just sort of goes on and on until he thinks he's seen enough, and then he decides the case, often with large gaps between the events. But that system is less sensitive to the imbalance between the two sides, what one scholar calls the wealth effect that distorts the adversary system. Okay. That said, I think that lawyers can become competent, not great, but competent. They can have a modicum of competence relatively soon, and such that the better case usually prevails. The discipline of the evidence prevails. And trial lawyers who have tried hundreds of cases often say, well, I think I may have made the difference in a couple of those cases, but it's the facts that really make the difference in the case. It's the discipline of the evidence. Once you reach a modicum of competence and engagement and attention to the case, and it's economic imbalances behind the case, if you want, that make that less likely to occur. So it's not such a so complicated a forum that only individuals who have enormously refined skills can even function there.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll speak next to Darren in Fort Worth. Hi, Darren.
Hi. I just had a kind of a two-part question. In my one opportunity to serve on a jury, or even in the selection process, it was I noticed that most people didn't want to be there and didn't want that opportunity, which I felt differently about. But I wondered if that might have any bearing on this decline in jury trials. And also, if in the 30 years that you've been talking about, the number of cases has increased in correlation to the drop in the number of jury trials.
I'll take the second one first. In the federal system, there have been five times as many cases filed, and yet a 60% decline in the absolute number of jury trials. So the entire legal world is growing. The briefs and lawyers and the billable hours and case law and statutes. So you have this enormous flowering, if you want, or weeding over of legal rules and the technical part of the legal system, with a decline in the number of jury trials. So that reflects that initial notion that we're heading towards a much more bureaucratized, less democratic legal system. No decline in legal matters generally, an actual increase in the legal world generally, with a decrease in the number of trials. Refusing or trying to avoid jury service, I think that's too bad. I think fewer people should be let out of jury service. That it's too easy to talk your way out of it. Some folks are just never going to want to do it, even though most folks, once they do it, think it was an elevating experience, an experience that they valued. I don't think there's been such a draught in the number of drought in the number of jurors that's really an effect had an effect in the numbers. I think jurors are often disappointed, talking about legitimacy and cynicism. Jurors are often disappointed at the ease with which they are dismissed. So they come, they make the arrangements they need to come and serve on a jury, and then they're dismissed with a peremptory challenge. And I think one of the real issues in this area is the extent to which peremptory challenges should be allowed to continue, and or whether all challenges should be for cause. That is, require the lawyer to identify some reason why he thinks this particular juror is not able to be is to be fair. So that's a real problem. There are reasons to keep peremptory challenges. It protects the parties from a judge who is unfair, because the judge really has no say in whether to dismiss a juror. But I think it increases the level of cynicism among jurors that they put out the effort to come and they're willing to serve and they're dismissed for no stated reasons. And I think that's an important issue that needs and is being addressed in many areas.
You write in the book about changes that have already been made to trial proceedings in order to address some of the most valid concerns about them. We don't really have time to go into that. We've just got less than a minute left. But I wonder if you could speak very briefly about any other changes that we might be able to make that might revive the American trial sort of as an institution.
Yeah, I mean the first change is really a consciousness raising change. Is that I think lawyers and judges and citizens have to begin to understand that the trial is the normal way, the default way, as computer literate folks say, that we resolve filed cases. And sure, most cases aren't going to go to trial, but that's the assumption we're going to go on, and it's a great institution, and we should head that way. There are many steps that should be taken to minimize hyper-technicality in the law of evidence, in some procedural areas as well, that reduce the expense of trials and the like, reduce the amount of delay, make them crisper and cleaner and simpler, yet preserve the power, I think, that the American jury trial has.
Robert P. Burns is professor at Northwestern University School of Law. His new book is called The Death of the American Trial. Bob, it's been a great conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.